is if there's a discussion of witnesses, and if we go to witnesses, Mr. Schumer's laid out the four he wants.
Mr. Chief Justice,
Senator from Delaware.
Chief Justice, on behalf of our colleagues, Senators Booker, Cardin, Kane, Markey, Menendez, Merkley, Murphy, and Shaheen, I send a question to the desk for our House managers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question from Senator Carper and the other senators addressed to the House managers. The President's aides and defenders have claimed that it is normal or usual to use U.S. foreign assistance as the President did to achieve a desired outcome. How was the President's act in withholding U.S. security assistance to Ukraine different from how the U.S. uses foreign assistance to achieve foreign policy goals and national security objectives? And how should we evaluate the defense argument that this is what is, quote, done all the time, end quote?
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, thank you for the question. So to understand the answer to this, you don't have to look inside the president's mind. You just have to look at recent history and then what was done last year. As I talked about earlier and even yesterday, other presidents have held holds and aid for legitimate reasons, even this president. We concede that there are a variety of legitimate policy reasons for holding aid, whether it be corruption or burden sharing. So even in the president's other holds, like Afghanistan, because of concerns about terrorism, or Central America, because of immigration concerns. And even though some might disagree with that, that is a legitimate policy debate. The difference here is that every witness testified, these 17 witnesses that you hear about, testified that there was no reason provided for the implementation of this hold. Right, I talked about earlier how there is a process for doing this, right? There is a well-prescribed process for allocating the funds, like we all did here in this chamber, and 87 of you agreed on. And then an interagency process to review it to make sure that it meets the standards and criteria outlined by this body, anti-corruption reforms. And that was done in this case. That interagency process was followed. That certification was made. The notification to Congress was conducted. The train had left the station, just like the train had left the station in 2018, in 2017, in 2016. And every element of the agencies and the bureaucracy involved in that process in prior years had been engaged and had signed off. Except this year, in 2019, rather, that all changed. A hold was implemented for no known reason. There was no notification given to Congress, which violated the Impoundment Control Act. DOD, Department of State, Secretary Esper, Secretary Pompeo, even Vice President Pence, and the entire National Security Council implored the president to release the aid because it not only had met all of the certifications, but it was in the U.S. national interest and consistent with U.S. policy. And yet, nobody knew why it happened. And to this day, the individual who could shed light on this, Mr. Bolton, is being prohibited from coming forward to explain why the president told him it happened. So yes, it is still a good time to subpoena Ambassador Bolton and get that information.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. The Senator from North Carolina.
Chief Justice, I have a question for both sets of counsels, sponsored by myself, Senator Cruz, Senator Scott of South Carolina, Hawley, Sass, and Rubio.
Thank you. Question from Senator Burr and the other senators is for both parties. The House will answer first. Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee hired a retired foreign spy to work with Russian contacts to build a dossier of opposition research against her political opponent, Donald Trump. Under the House manager's standard, would the Steele dossier be considered as foreign interference in a U.S. election, a violation of the law, and or an impeachable offense?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and distinguished senators. I thank you for the question. The analogy is not applicable to the present situation because, first, to the extent that opposition research was obtained. It was opposition research that was purchased. But this speaks to the underlying issue of the avoidance of facts, the avoidance of the reality of what President Trump did in this particular circumstance. Now, I have tremendous respect for the President's counsel, but one of the arguments that we consistently hear on the floor of this Senate, this great institution in America's democracy, is conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory. We've heard about the deep state conspiracy theory. We've heard about the Adam Schiff is the root of all evil conspiracy theory. We've heard about the Burisma conspiracy theory. We've heard about the CrowdStrike conspiracy theory. We've heard about the whistleblower conspiracy theory. It's hard to keep count. This is the Senate. This is America's most exclusive political club. This is the world's greatest deliberative body. And all you offer us is conspiracy theories? Because you can't address the facts in this case that the president corruptly abused his power to target an American citizen for political and personal gain. He tried to cheat in the election by soliciting foreign interference. That is an impeachable offense. That is a crime against the Constitution. That is the reason that we are here. That is what is before this great body of distinguished senators.
Thank you, Mr. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, so I guess you could buy, this is what it sounds like, you can buy a foreign interference. You could if you purchase it, if you purchase their opposition research, I guess it's okay. So let me try to debunk the conspiracy, Manager Jeffries, and that is, it is not a conspiracy that Christopher Steele was engaged to obtain and prepare a dossier on the presidential candidate for the Republican Party, Donald Trump. It is not a conspiracy that Christopher Steele utilized his network of assets, including assets apparently in Russia, to draft the dossier. It is not a conspiracy that the dossier was shared with the Department of Justice through Bruce Orr, who was the number four ranking member of the Department of Justice at that time, because his wife, Nellie Orr, happened to be working for the organization Fusion GPS that was putting the dossier together. This is also not a conspiracy. It sounds like one, except it's real. And it's also not a conspiracy that that dossier, purchased dossier, was taken by the FBI, submitted to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to obtain a foreign intelligence surveillance order on an American citizen. It is also not a conspiracy that that court issued an order, two of them now, condemning the FBI's practice and acknowledging that many of those orders were not properly issued. None of that is a conspiracy theory. That's just the facts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The senator from Wisconsin.
Mr. Chief Justice, I send a question to the desk for both President's counsel and House managers.
Thank you. Question from Senator Baldwin is for both parties, and counsel for the president will answer first. Can you assure us that the Jennifer Williams document submitted to the House was not classified secret for any reasons prohibited by Executive Order 13526, such as preventing embarrassment to a person? If yes, please describe or identify the serious damage to national security that would be caused by declassifying this document pursuant to the same executive order.
Mr. Chief Justice and Senator, in response to your question, the Trump administration's policy is always to abide by the requirements for classification of material. And the classification, my understanding is that that document is derivatively classified because it refers to another document, a transcript that was originally classified. I can't represent to you the specific reasons that the classification officer classified that document, but I can tell you that it was originally classified according to proper procedures. It is a properly classified document because that is the policy of the administration to follow the classification procedures. The memorandum that she submitted is derivatively classified because of that transcript. Now, that transcript relates to a conversation with a foreign head of state. Almost all conversations with foreign heads of state are classified. And they're classified because the confidentiality related to those communications is important for ensuring that there can be candid conversations with foreign heads of state. The president took an extraordinary action in declassifying two of his conversations with foreign heads of state, unprecedented, because he carefully weighed the balance of what was at stake in this case and the need for transparency for the American public in those two conversations. But that was an exception to the usual rule that such conversations are properly classified.
Thank you, counsel.
I would encourage you, if you haven't already had the opportunity, to read that document for yourself and ask you whether you think there's any legitimate basis to classify that supplemental testimony. Now, the vice president has said that he had no knowledge of this scheme. He's denied any knowledge, involvement in any way, shape, or form. We heard the testimony of Ambassador Sondland that Ambassador Sondland raised with the vice president that the aid was being held up and was tied to these investigations. And the vice president didn't say, what are you talking about? That could never be. The president would never allow such a thing. There was nothing but a silent nod of acknowledgement with what he was being told. But nonetheless, the vice president says that he knew nothing. And the vice president points to the open testimony of Jennifer Williams to support that contention. But the classified submission goes to that phone call between the vice president and President Zelensky. You should read that and ask yourself whether that submission is being classified because it would either embarrass or undermine what the president and the vice president are saying, or there's some legitimate reason. Now, the vice president at one point said that he wanted to release the record of his call. He certainly talked all about this issue, as has the president. If it was so classified, then why are they all talking about it? But we are to be assured that this classification decision was made absolutely above board. I'm sure that John Bolton's manuscript will be treated with the same rigid, objective scrutiny. You read that. Don't take my word for it. You read that and you ask yourselves, is there anything that other than avoiding evidence that the administration doesn't want you to see, that the public shouldn't see Jennifer Williams' supplemental testimony? I don't think you can conclude that it is, except that it would be inconsistent with what you're being told and what the American people are being told. Well, they deserve the whole truth, and that's part of the truth. So let the public see it.
Thank you, Mr. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The Senator from Tennessee.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I send a question to the desk on behalf of myself, Senator Daines, and Senator Cruz.
Thank you. The question from Senators Alexander, Daines, and Cruz is for the House managers. Compare the bipartisanship in the Nixon, Clinton, and Trump impeachment proceedings. Specifically, how bipartisan was the vote in the House of Representatives to authorize and direct the House committees to begin formal impeachment inquiries for each of the three presidents?
Mr. Chief Justice and Senators, in the Nixon impeachment, we look back and we think about the vote on the House Judiciary Committee that ended up bipartisan, but it didn't start that way. The parties were as dug in as parties are today. The Republicans and Democrats saw it differently. But as the evidence emerged, a bipartisan consensus emerged on the committee, and a number of Republicans, Tom Railsback, who just passed away, Caldwell Butler, who loved Richard Nixon. He was a huge fan of Richard Nixon, but they couldn't turn away from the evidence that their president had committed abuse of power, cheat in the election, and that they had to vote to impeach him. When it came to the Clinton impeachment, that was, again, it started out along very partisan lines, and it ended along partisan lines. And I believe the reason why, as I said a short while earlier, was that we never had a high crime and misdemeanor. That was the problem. With Nixon, we had clear abuse of presidential authority to upend the constitutional scheme, to cheat in an election, and members of both parties voted to impeach. With Clinton, we had private misconduct. Yes, I think probably a crime, because he lied about that under oath, but it wasn't misuse of presidential authority. As I said, any husband caught in an affair could have lied about it, and it didn't involve the use of presidential authority. And so we never got beyond our partisan divisions on that, and many of us, and I will include myself, believe that it was being done for a partisan purpose because it didn't reach a high crime and misdemeanor. In the Trump case, and I'll say I've been disappointed because I serve with a number of Republicans in the House who I like, who I respect, who I work with on legislation, and I honestly believe that when this evidence came out, as with in the Nixon administration, we would have a coming together, but it didn't happen, much to my disappointment. I think you have a new opportunity here in the Senate. For one thing, this is a smaller body. You are, as has been mentioned, the greatest deliberative body on the planet. You have an opportunity to do something that we didn't have the chance to do, which is to call firsthand witnesses and hear from them. We have a lot of things happened since the impeachment articles were adopted. One of them were emails that had been released that we didn't know about. See, it's been said that by counsel that the Freedom of Information Act information just shows if you follow the process, you get information. No, they had to sue, and they're still in a lockdown fight over the Freedom of Information Act and the redactions that were not proper. So that's a big fight that's still going on, but we've got information. But most tellingly, Mr. Bolton has now stepped forward and said he's willing to testify. He's willing to come here and testify under oath. And I think we would all learn something. And as Mr. Schiff has mentioned, I think we can structure this in such a way that it will respect the Senate's need to do other business, which we also feel in the House. Let's get that done, and let's see if that kind of information can help the senators come together, as happened in the House Judiciary Committee so many years ago when we dealt with the serious problem of presidential misconduct, abuse of power to cheat an election, when Richard Nixon shocked the nation and ultimately had to resign.
Thank you, Ms. Manager.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The Democratic leader is recognized.
I send a question to the desk for the House managers.
Thank you. The question from Senator Schumer for the House managers. Many of our colleagues are worried that if we were able to bring witnesses and documents in the trial, it would take too long. Mr. Schiff mentioned we could do depositions in 1 week. Please elaborate. What can you say that will reassure us that having witnesses and documents can be done in a short time, minimally impeding the business of the Senate?
I thank the Senator for the question. First of all, with respect to the documents that we subpoenaed and sought to get in the House, those documents have been collected. So that work has been done. We've been informed, for example, the State Department documents have been collected. Those could readily be provided to the Senate for its consideration. With respect to witnesses, if we agree to a one-week period to do depositions while you continue to conduct the business of the Senate, it doesn't mean that we would have unlimited witnesses during that week. We would have to decide on witnesses who are relevant and probative of the issues. Neither side would have an unlimited capacity to call endless witnesses. We would have a limited period of time, just as we had a limited period of time for our opening presentations and for this question and answer period. If there was any dispute over whether a witness is truly material and probative, that decision could be made by the Chief Justice in very short order. If there was a dispute as to whether a passage in a document is covered by an applicable privilege, and if for the first time the White House should actually invoke a privilege, the Chief Justice could decide, is that properly laid, or is that merely an attempt to conceal crime or fraud? So this can be done very quickly. This can be done, I think, effectively. We have never sought to depose every witness under the face of the sun. We have specified four in particular that we think are particularly appropriate and relevant here, but we should be able to reach an agreement on concluding that process within a week. So that's how we would contemplate it, that it being done. We make that proposal to our opposing counsel. It would be respectful of your time. It would, I think, be a reasonable accommodation. My counsel says that the Constitution mandates a reasonable accommodation. Well, let's have a reasonable accommodation here. And a reasonable accommodation would be, we'll take 1 week, you'll continue with the business in the Senate, we'll do the depositions, and then we'll come back and we'll present to you what the witnesses had to say in those depositions. And that's how we contemplate the process would work.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. The Majority Leader is recognized.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'm about to send a question to the desk, but I'm going to suggest that following the response to my question and one more Democratic question, we take a 45-minute break for dinner. So I send a question to the desk.
I'm sure there's no objection. The senator from the Majority Leader is for the counsel for the president. Would you please respond to the question on bipartisanship by Senator Alexander and any assertions the House managers made in response to any of the previous questions?
Mr. Chief Justice, Majority Leader, thank you for that question. And in response to Senator Lamar's question about bipartisanship, I beg your pardon, Senator Alexander. Senator Alexander, your question. The In the Nixon case, the authorizing resolution, this is in the House to authorize the inquiry, was passed by a vote of 410-4. 410 voted in favor of the inquiry, only 4 voted against. 232 Democrats, 177 Republicans, and 1 independent voted in favor. In the Clinton authorizing resolution, this was House Resolution 581 to actually authorize just the beginning of the inquiry. It passed by a vote of 258-176. 31 Democrats joined 227 Republicans voting in favor of authorizing that inquiry. That was substantial bipartisan support to authorize the inquiry. In this case, House Resolution 660, which was passed on October 31st, had bipartisan opposition. The votes in favor of the resolution were 231 Democrats and 1 independent. The opposition was all Republicans, 194, plus 2 Democrats voting against. In terms of other assertions that have been made, there are just a couple of points I wanted to touch on. There's been a lot said about the House managers have suggested that the Counsel for the President have argued that the President could do anything he wants now to solicit any foreign interference in any election. If he thinks it will help him get elected, that's okay, that's the theory of the case. That is absolutely false. That is a gross distortion of what has been presented. And let me make a couple of points about that. There have been questions about the campaign finance laws, and one narrow point that we have made in response to specific questions about the campaign finance laws is simply that information, limited information, being presented to a party is not a contribution, a thing of value under the campaign finance laws. And that, it's not just my conclusion, that's what the Mueller report said. When the Mueller report looked into this, said, no judicial decision has treated the voluntary provision of uncompensated opposition research or similar information as a thing of value that could amount to a contribution under campaign finance law. That was volume 1 at page 187. So that's a limited point. The bigger point, the suggestion has been made because of Professor Dershowitz's comments that the theory that the President's counsel is advancing is the President can do anything he wants. If he thinks it will advance his re-election, any quid pro quo, anything he wants, anything goes. And that is not true. Professor Dershowitz today issued a statement to show that that was an exaggeration of what he was saying. But let me make the even more narrow point. Aside from what Professor Dershowitz was saying the other night and explaining in abstract and hypothetical terms and academic terms, we have a specific case here. And the specific case here is the one that's been framed by the House managers. And the defects in that case and in their theory of the case are a theory of abuse of power that involves no allegation of a crime whatsoever, no allegation of a violation of established law. Instead, the theory that you can take action that on its face is objectively permissible under the powers of the President and determine that it's going to be treated as impeachable and impermissible solely on an inquiry into subjective motives. That's what the House Judiciary Committee report says. That is a theory that is infinitely malleable. It provides no standard, no real standard at all. And that was one core point that Professor Dershowitz was making, that it is tantamount to impeachment for maladministration. And the other point I'll make is they set the standard for themselves with respect to investigations that they have to establish in order to establish their bad motive, that there is not a scintilla of evidence. There is nothing that you can look at that would suggest any possible legitimate national interest in inquiring into 2016 election interference or the Biden-Burisma affair. They can't possibly meet that standard. It is overdetermined that there is a legitimate policy interest in at least raising a question about those things. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Yes, the senator from Delaware.
On behalf of myself and Senator Klobuchar, I send a question to the desk addressed to the President's counsel and the House managers.
Thank you. The House will go first in answering the question from Senator Coons and Klobuchar. Mr. Sekulow said earlier that the President's counsel would expect to call their own witnesses in this trial if Mr. Bolton or others are called by the House managers. Can you tell the Senate if any of those witnesses would have firsthand knowledge of the charges against the President and his actions?
Mr. Justice, Senator, there certainly are witnesses that the President could call with firsthand information. I don't know that they're the witnesses that they have described so far. Their position is, apparently, if you are the chairman of a committee doing an investigation, that makes you a relevant witness. It doesn't, or you've all become witnesses in your own investigations. They want to call Joe Biden as a witness. Joe Biden can't tell us why military aid was withheld from Ukraine while it was fighting a war. Joe Biden can't tell us why President Zelensky couldn't get in the door of the White House while the Russian foreign minister could. He's not in a position to answer those questions. He can't tell us whether this rises to an impeachable abuse of power, although he probably has opinions on the subject. But are there witnesses they could call? Absolutely. They have said, Mick Mulvaney issued a statement saying, the President never said what I said he had said earlier. Well, if that's the case, then why don't they call Mick Mulvaney? He should be on their witness list. If Secretary Pompeo has evidence that there was a policy basis to withhold the aid and it was discussed, well, then why don't they call him? That's a relevant fact witness. They don't want to allow the Chief Justice to decide issues of materiality because they know what they're trying to do involves witnesses that don't shed light on the charges against the President. They do satisfy the appetite of their client, but they don't have probative value to the issues here. So, yes, there are witnesses. Now, the reason they're not on the President's witness list is because if they were truthful under oath, they would incriminate the President. Otherwise, they would be begging to have Mick Mulvaney come testify. Otherwise, they'd be begging to have the head of OMB, who helped administer the freeze on behalf of the President. Let's bring him in. He'll tell you. It was completely innocent. It was all about burden sharing. So why don't they want the head of OMB in? Why don't they want their own people in? Because their own people will incriminate the President. But there's no shortage of relevant probative witnesses. They just don't want you to hear what they have to say.
Mr. Manager.
Besides the fact that Mr. Schumer said, and it's on page 675 of the transcript, that we could call any witnesses we want, Mr. Schiff just said we can call their witnesses. And that's what he said. You can call their witnesses because under their theory, if we wanted to talk to the whistleblower, even in a secure setting, to find out if he in fact may have worked for the Vice President or may have worked on Ukraine, or may have been in communication with the staff, that's irrelevant. We can't talk to Joe Biden or Hunter Biden because that's irrelevant, except the conversation that is the subject matter of this inquiry, the phone call transcript that you selectively utilize, has a reference to Hunter Biden. The conversation with Burisma, they raised it for about a half a day, saying there was nothing there. Well, let me find out through cross-examination. But I just think the irony of this before we go to dinner, that we could call anyone we want except the witnesses we want, but we can call their witnesses that they want. Remember we said the fruit of the poisonous tree? It's still the fruit of the poisonous tree. It doesn't get better with age, as I said. But this idea that this is going to be a fair process, call the witnesses they want. Don't call the witnesses you want because they're irrelevant. Maybe irrelevant to them. They are not irrelevant to the President. And they're not irrelevant to our case. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Counsel, Mr. Majority Leader, I understand we have 45 minutes.
If only it was so simple. Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I'm from Hudson.
I'm Lena, and I'm from Hudson and Florida, and I go to school at MC Smith.
Hi, I'm AJ. I'm 9 years old. I go to school at Leibury, and I was born in Philadelphia, moved to Manhattan when I was Manhattan/Queens when I was 2 days old, and then I lived there for a couple of years, and now I moved here. I'm happy to be here.
Yay, welcome. I was born in Illinois, and then I moved to New Hampshire when I was one, and then I lived there until I went to college in New York State. And then I made it up to Hudson in 2007.
Wow.
Wow, because how I came here was I was born here, and then as soon as I was born, they packed up stuff, and then we went straight down to Florida. I lived there for a couple of years, and my sister had friends, but she told me something that she thinks is funny, and it's something that her friends in Florida called her, the white Mexican, because she's really light, and we're Mexicans, and I'm pretty sure we're supposed to be known as dark. I don't know, but like we moved back up here after like a couple of days, and I was
after a couple of days.
I mean, not a couple of days after a couple.
I was like,
years.
That's called a vacation.
After a couple of years, like 3 years, and then we moved back up here, and I was getting used to my surroundings, and I'm like. And, like, it was pretty weird because I hadn't started any type of school yet. Mm. And also, I always looked out the window of the living room. And I thought it was weird how, like, it was magic because, like, the apartment that we live in, it would go into, like, a window. Well, it was the fire escape, and then we'd go left, and then they would open a window, which I thought was weird, and this is probably just a dream, because I probably just fell asleep or something like that. It looked like one of the windows from our house, they opened it, and then it was like a red room, and they were doors. But like the first 3 days here in Hudson were weird. Like there was a chair and it was broken. And the next day there was a pole stuck in there saying like thank you or you're welcome in different languages. And the chair was in pieces and bits from the day before.
Well, that is actually a very weird story. Did the rest of your family notice? Or was
no, it was only just me and my siblings. And then on the third day, the chair disappeared. And then on the fourth day, the chair appeared again.
The haunting of the chair.
Oh my god!
Yeah, and also, one of my favorite memories that I remember in Kingston is the ghost cart. Which was a cart that moved by its own, and we were, like, real scared of it, but, like, it was probably just the wind.
Weird.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we all made it up here.
Yeah.
So that we can talk about books, because that's what we do on Bound by Books.
Books we love, books we dislike, bookish things.
I like that you said books we dislike.
Yeah.
Hate's too strong of a word.
Yeah.
I very rarely hate a book. Because usually if I don't like a book very much, I just stop reading it before it gets to the point that I'd hate it.
Speaking of books, I have this book that I would like to share with everyone. So sad that I forgot to bring a book again. Oh my god.
What's the book?
It's called The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar and Six Others by Roald Dahl. And one of my favorite ones is The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. And so Henry is a gambling man and he's very rich. And one day he was visiting his other gambling friends with five other people. And then they played this game at their house because it was raining. And he drew an unlucky card. and then he went to explore the house. He found a library, and he was about to stop searching for books because he was looking for books because there was nothing else to do. And then he found this little blue book that said, "The Man Who Could See With His Eyes Closed." He read it, and then he tried to use the training, and then he could see through objects. And then he used that to gamble, but then he realized that everyone else there was selfish and greedy because I think all of that has changed him. And he decided to change his whole entire body and put costumes all over him and make, well, not really all over him because then he would look like a monster, but put different costumes on him in different places with different passports from different places so that nobody could ever track down how much he was winning. And then he saved all the money, and then he helped build awesome 5-star orphanages around the world instead of like the one in Annie with the crummy Miss Hannigan.
Wait, aren't you basically like telling us what this story is, kinda?
Yeah, well, when you actually read it, it's way better than my description.
Okay.
I've never read that story. So it's a book of short stories?
By Roald Dahl. But the last one, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, is actually the longest.
Okay. Stop stealing books.
I think she should be the one in the book thief.
The book thief?
Yeah.
No, that book's too sad. I don't want AJ to be in that book.
No, she should be in that book.
That's cool.
Emily, keep it safe.
I've
read some Roald Dahl, but I haven't read that one.
Oh.
So you liked it?
Roald Dahl was super funny. But that book was kind of funny, but more intense. Mm-hmm. And it was a change for Roald Dahl. All of those other stories were a big change for him. Because usually in books like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Fantastic Mr. Fox, they're more exciting characters. But in these 7 stories, it was more like intense, but the way that he wrote it was very, very good. And I really like to reread that story, especially The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, because I try to do what Henry Sugar did. And I actually don't think that it's impossible, because there have actually been...
The gambling or the costumes?
No, the seeing through objects, because people have actually seen ghosts and taken pictures of them. So if ghosts are possible, then why can't seeing through things be possible? Like, you never know what's gonna happen.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of that one riddle when you mentioned a ghost from 7 Second Riddles. It was like, I have a picture of a ghost. And then, like, I forgot what her name was, but we're just going to call her Lillian. Lillian! It was just a joke. And then they show you these pictures. And there's one picture with all of them in it. Huh, I wonder who took a picture of that. That's right, ghosts. And also, like, in the beginning, it show you literally a ghost. So, like, you know that there's a ghost there.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Yes, because if angels are real, then ghosts are real. And if ghosts are real, then angels are real.
All right.
Well, I guess that means that you believe in angels?
Yeah, I guess. Maybe.
Because if angels are real, then ghosts are real. And if ghosts are real, then angels are real.
Yeah.
Then dragons are real.
No.
Do you think they're visible?
Well, like, sometimes to the human eye, because I think I have a bunch of ghosts in my house, because I remember I was trying to get the milk and I saw someone right next to me and I was really scared, and then I looked and then they were gone.
Or it could have been shadows, or maybe your eyes were playing tricks on you.
No.
Do you believe in ghosts, AJ?
I do.
I don't know if I do.
I do.
But I think that that's really bad for me, because there are pros and cons to having a bedroom all to yourself for like the first time in a very long time. You start seeing things and...
Maybe there are just good ghosts.
I hope that there are no bad ghosts, because if there are, then I'm going to be like, okay, maybe sharing a room with my little sister Aaliyah isn't such a bad idea after all.
I also believe in ghosts because Ouija board. That's right. I played it. We got scared by the closet man or what's his face. I didn't get scared by Keely's grandmother. Boom, done. We know that ghosts are real. Now we can leave.
The only time I did a Ouija board with some friends, I didn't believe, and so I helped move it. Because I was pretty sure my friend was moving it. So then at some point, somebody accused her of moving it. And so she picked up her hands. She was like, it's not me. So then I started moving it. And then they were like, it's you. And then I picked up my hands and she moved it. So one of our friends really believes in ghosts.
Wow.
I don't remember who. But
I was like, hey, you need to stop moving it. And this was at a sleepover. And they all said, I'm not moving it. And then we asked them, are you a good spirit? And like the dummies we were, we got scared by them saying no. It's not like they're even going to kill us or anything. Mm-hmm. And also, like, no. AJ.
AJ. I was just joking.
Actually, I'm wondering, Lena, do you have any book you want to talk about?
Yes, and it kind of has to do with segregation.
Huh.
So we had to read a book about teammates, and it was about a man. I forgot what his name was, but we can call him Cowboy Grandpa. And so Cowboy Grandpa was the manager of a baseball team that's like closed, like it had something to do with the Yankees, like it was Lakers baseball team or whatever it's called. They'll just call it Cowboy Grandpa Awesome Team.
Okay.
So Cowboy Grandpa was the manager of the team, and he needed a really good baseball player. And so he was looking and looking and looking, and he didn't care what skin color they were. He just tried to find a good baseball player. And so he was looking and looking and looking and looking and looking and looking.
Did he play?
And no, he's the manager of the team. That means, like, they're like, okay, time out. You do this.
Kind of he just played, if and, he knows how to play.
Oh, yeah.
Not everybody
okay,
that knows how to play plays well, though.
Yeah. So, and then Cowboy Grandpa found the legend that went down into history. And you may recognize his team as soon as you hear this name, Jackie Robinson.
Hmm.
Cowboy Grandpa put Jackie Robinson as their new recruit. Yeah, and the team was mostly made up of white people, and they did not like having an African American person on their team. So later on in the book, he like won and like them a lot of ones and.
Yeah, they probably changed their mind once they realized how good he was.
You thought.
I did.
Yeah. And they wanted to sign, like, a petition to kick Jackie off of the team. And we're going to introduce you to a new character, Pee-wee. So, Pee-wee.
Is that the real name?
That's what they called him okay. in the book. So, Pee-wee was the last person to sign the petition. I'm pretty sure you're supposed to like have a petition, make everyone sign the petition so you can do it. And they're like, let's kick Jackie off of the team since he is an African American. And Pee-wee's like, yeah, no, I'm not gonna kick them off the team because I don't care what skin color he is. If he's white, if he's African American, if he has stripes, if he's red. And so he said that. And then later on in the end, everyone's booing at, like, everyone's being mean to Jackie when he comes up to pitch. I think it was, or like to hit the ball or pitch. I forgot what you do on baseball. Like to throw the ball, hit the ball. So everyone was being rude to him. And then Pee-wee came up and stood right next to Jackie Robinson. And the crowd went silent. And then Pee-wee smiled at Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson smiled back. And then he stood right next to Jackie Robinson. He basically said, I don't care what skin color this man is. He's my teammate and I'm his. And the question was like, what would you name the title? Why was the title called Teammates and why?
Like, that seems like a frequent assignment you have.
Yeah.
We have to like think about the title.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And so like I said, the title should be named Teammates because Pee-wee and Jackie Robinson were friends and he was his teammate, and he should act like it. And he did not sign the petition and try to get Jackie off of the team like the jerks the other people were. So, yeah.
It's good he stood up for his teammate.
Yeah.
Speaking of what you said before in this story, I don't care if they're white or African-American. I don't care if they have stripes or red. And I just wanted to make a joke about them being red. So if that person is red, they spent a long day at the beach and had a huge sunburn. Mm-hmm. It must hurt.
Yeah. Ouch.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes more back in the day, it's not really considered appropriate now, but sometimes Native American or American Indians were referred to as Redskins. That's why there's like the Washington Redskins.
Oh.
So when they talk about someone's skin being red or them being
red. They have a big sunburn.
It's, that would be more appropriate.
I mean, not that
a sunburn's appropriate, but
it's
very painful.
Help me.
Yeah.
No. Oh.
And also, I have a pun for you.
A pun?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's black and white and red all over?
Something with the sunburn?
No. Maybe out.
A penguin with a sunburn.
What's black?
A penguin that spilled Kool-Aid all over itself.
A newspaper that has strawberry jam?
No.
It's a zebra.
Well, that's close.
That painted the barn red and was very sloppy.
Wow, you guys are coming up with more creative ideas than me because I put a zebra with a sunburn.
That was close to a penguin with a sunburn.
Yeah, but what the actual answer should be is a newspaper because it's black and white and it's red all over. Ah, ha, 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 a book joke.
I get it.
Yeah.
I like the other answers more.
I have
a book to talk about.
Yay!
It is called Click, and it's by Kayla Miller, and it's a graphic novel, and it's the first in a series.
Graphic novel, can I please read it? Please, 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 please.
Yeah, not right now, but after.
No!
But I borrowed this one because Kayla Miller is going to be at the Hudson Children's Book Festival this year.
Oh, yay!
Which, since AJ is new, and some of her listeners might not know either, on the first Saturday of May every year, so this year it's on Saturday, May 2nd, there's a children's book festival at the junior senior high school here in Hudson where authors and illustrators from all over come to share their work. And you get to go around and meet them and you
read the books and read the books and read the books and read the books and read the books. Yay!
Yeah. And if you buy books, you can get them signed. And then they usually have fun events. And then a lot of the authors and illustrators visit schools. I don't know if they visit Libri, but they could.
They always visit my school. And one of the authors told us a story. And I'm pretty sure it was like Seymour Simon. He would always put fake books in the bookshelves and he would always hide a pencil and some paper inside so whenever he wanted I think he could write or draw or something like that.
Cool.
And then this one I think was the person who made Big Idea Gang. They had a story that they had a big sister and they dared them to run around naked the house. Yeah, and he was hiding in the bushes, and everyone was trying to take pictures of him.
Oh, my
God. And his dad came home, and then he started crying. And he's like, sis did this. She locked me out of the house when I was naked. And, like, he made a map of his house, and the bathroom said, bathroom door, do not lock, because he would turn on the water, and he would pretend to take a shower. This happened once. And then he read instead of taking a shower. And also, whenever it's summer, he opens the freezer and he just reads in front of the freezer.
That's very wasteful.
No.
But anyways, wasteful energy. I'm glad he gets some relief in the summertime and reads his book. But I'm going to tell you about this book. It's called Click, and it's spelled C-L-I-C-K, but it is actually based on clicks, C-L-I-Q-U-E-S. Do you know what a click is?
Yeah, it's like a group like where someone fits in, like the jocks, the mean girls who are cheerleaders, then the quote-unquote nerds. Like, those are examples for, like, movie cliques. Real-life cliques are, like, the artsy kids, the bullies, and
the bookworms like me.
Yeah, and sometimes it doesn't have to necessarily be based around something. So
or
like,
friend groups.
Yeah, obvious. It's basically.
It could just be friend groups, too.
Yeah.
But so the main character in this book is named Olive, and she's in fifth grade, and everybody basically gets along, which is kind of nice about this book. I feel like often I read books about, I don't know, middle school, and it's just like there's always some really mean people or people that...
Like Cub?